Levitt's Dream. June 26, 1950, Chuncheon Province, South Korea. He can hear the pain, shifting and moving, a big animal somewhere close. He knows he's hurt bad and he holds still, looking hard into the perfect white. The pain presses at him, pushing, sliding near and veering away. And he drifts, half-conscious, waiting for it to find him. There are banks of cloud, vast, featureless, soft. He sees a shape below him, a curve in space, a mountainous line against a sea, the Taibak Range, rocky and broken, running like a north-south spine along the Sea of Japan. They're the same barren, unforgiving mountains that rose above Taijiang and overhung the lowlands he crossed and tracked and hated during the retreat. Now they shine, banked with clouds, spread out like some dinosaur's blasted ivory skeleton. Beautiful country, he thinks, so hot and so cold, and knows he's in a dream. It's winter in the mountains, and the clouds are snow, drifted and deep, horrendously white, yet he feels no cold. He feels nothing but sees the moon set along the jagged peaks, a pale bulge round as an orange until it settles further down, snug against the foothills. He hears a cry then, and the land shifts, settles, and lengthens. Like a woman, he thinks, like Lola, turning away from him in sleep. He wants to trace the long, smooth line of her body, run his fingers from ankle to thigh to hip. The rounded globe of her belly, seemingly within reach, glows like a moon he can touch. His legs are senseless, but he can move his arms, his empty hands. He reaches for her, but she's far away. He sees her below him, gowned as though for a ceremony, flat on her back in a white room, the hard plane of a steel table under her and her knees pulled up under sheets. The baby isn't born, and she's bleeding. It's her pain he hears, deepening, closing in. A burnished pewter light wavers as he tries to approach. The pearled edges of the tableau darken, flickering every time he tries to move. He opens his eyes. The movement of light is tracer fire crossing against the stones above him. He's on his back in the grit of the tunnel, and he feels a subtle thrum in the ground. He thinks it's the approach of tanks or heavy artillery until he remembers the stream on the other side of the tunnel wall. The tunnel exaggerates sound, displaces echo, vibration. There are indistinct voices, whispers. It's dark, and the Korean girl has got them midway in against the side of the tunnel, where the dirt of the road meets the inner wall. Levitt hears scattered artillery reports. Soldiers dug in just beyond the front and rear of the tunnel are firing sporadically. He lies still. If he doesn't move, the pain locates just beside him, and he can think. He feels the girl behind him. She's taken the boy from her back and put him on the ground between them. Now she pulls Levitt onto his side, into the curve of the wall, and presses the boy down behind him. Levitt feels for the butt of his revolver against his belly, under his shirt. The gun is gone. Blindly, he feels for the revolver on the ground. He has it in his hand, pulled close, when he hears the girl talking to the old woman. She's in front of them, kneeling upright. The girl's telling her to lie down, stay flat on the ground, but the old woman moves closer to Levitt and looks into his face. She's frail, smaller than the girl, her lined face almost simian. Her small eyes are black in their raisin folds. He hears her curse him under her breath, like a whisper or chant, and then she spits on him. There's a rush of Korean words from the girl as she wipes the spittle from Levitt's face. Crouched behind him near the wall with the boy, she touches him with flattened palms, his eyes, the line of his jaw, his cheeks that are stubbled with a week's beard, as though to put him back together, repair the insult. Her hands are warm and dry, slim and weightless as a child's, but her touch is deliberate. Maybe she isn't a child. He remembers the shadow shape of Tompkins and his girl on the paper wall of the brothel in Seoul. The girl suspended in Tompkins' arms was probably no older than this one. It was always that girl. Tompkins let her choose which others they took upstairs with them, a means of supporting her status, winning her favor. The youngest girls called him Yong Nim, older brother, and formed an audience of sorts. They exclaimed like little kids as Tompkins held his girl aloft over the bed, turning her, balanced on the soles of his feet as she extended her arms and legs, a performer poised in midair. Tompkins and his girls were beautiful then, siblings playing a circus game. Levitt hears the words, "Haumoni, yogi." The Korean girl is whispering urgently to the old woman, who sits motionless, inches away, staring at the ground. She ignores the girl and croons a kind of dirge. She might be crazy, or the war has driven her crazy. She might be a shaman, a practitioner of what the country people called tonggak, the heavenly way. Superstition and magic. The elderly rural people still believe in mudang priestesses, chan sung spirit posts, chap sang protection. Levitt hears words and phrases. "He's a murderer," she says, "an evil demon. He's not alive." She spits into the dirt, then prostrates herself over her own offering, as though before a temple deity. She believes he's a murderous spirit wandering among the dead. The old woman's mistaken, Levitt thinks ruefully. If he were a spirit, he would fly from here, lifted like a mist, and take these children with him. Tompkins is looking for him, if Tompkins is alive. He's still certain he heard or sensed Tompkins' voice on the radio. This is not enemy. Like a phantom transmission. "You must listen to me," Levitt tells the girl in careful Korean. He can see in the dark the shapes of bodies lying where they fell, villagers wounded in the strafing who made it to the tunnel and died, or survivors killed by sporadic fire. The Koreans still alive are terrified, silent, huddled near the tunnel walls or lying flat on the ground, unmoving. The nervous American troops seem undirected, pinned down, or shooting it at a whim. The fire make it worse. Levitt wants to tell the girl to get him to the tunnel entrance at first light. He wants to keep his eyes open, focused, but he's shutting down, losing track, his consciousness manufacturing images as though to compensate for his entrapment, his injuries. The images feel vivid, acute, a sensory expansion or avoidance. It doesn't feel aimless. It feels like information. Direction cut adrift from space or time. He senses Tompkins' restless, impatient energy raging near him, searching. Tompkins considered himself equally menaced by North Korean troops and American command. "Command kept your ass in a sling," Tompkins said, "while the communists shot at it." Levitt knows he can't depend on Tompkins to find them. A panicked platoon may have taken casualties and scattered after the second strafing, left the wounded. Tompkins might be hurt or dying. Levitt's attention blurs, then sharpens. He sees Tompkins looking at him intently, peering at him as though into an enclosed space through a window. Then they're together in open air, moving effortlessly through a densely green Korean landscape. It's a sunny day. The sound of the war roars past like a train they forgot to board, but they don't acknowledge it. They're in a country grove where it's shady and quiet. They stop under the trees.